Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Rusty Quill presents.
Hey everyone, Alexi Talanda here, and welcome to our bonus content as we work on putting Ostium Season 6 together. We're continuing with our Behind the Ostium series as we go in-depth with the making and discussion of how each episode of Ostium came to be, as well as much more. I am joined by Dwayne Farver, a big fan of the show and creator of the spin-off podcast Manifestations. If you enjoy the Behind the Ostium series, you can get full access to over 50 episodes right now by supporting Team Ostium on Patreon at patreon.com/ostiumpodcast. You'll also get access to a bunch of other bonus content on there too. Once again, that's patreon.com/ostiumpodcast. We'll continue working on getting Ostium Season 6 ready for release in 2022, but for now, sit back and enjoy another episode of Behind the Ostium.
Alright, who else we got?
Well, I can't not mention Robert Heinlein, because I think the book that I like the most of his is The Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
It's probably the most political book that he's done, strictly political.
Right.
His books all deal with politics, but
especially with sovereignty and the idea of, you know, colonizing, and then the people, you know, which of course it's very familiar with, people wanting to become their own independent, you know, country or planet or body,
and how the colony is used by. They're a resource more than they're considered less than, mm-hmm. because their only worth on the moon is sending resources back to the earth, mm-hmm. And it, especially because they were started as a penal colony, but now there are quote unquote free people on the moon that can't return. I'm not sure of the science behind that. That someone born on the moon would never be able to live on the Earth, but
Did you read? I remember we were talking a little about the Ian MacDonald Luna series.
No, I didn't.
Okay, because that's obviously doing a lot of homage to this, where they've colonized the moon pretty well, and there's different dynastic families that control different resources on the moon. There's like an Australian family that controls. What resource it is. It's like generating power in some way. Another one is generating water, because water is so important, and air and things like that, and that everything's controlled and measured by what you have and what you can use. But I remember I reread the series recently, because the third book came out, which I wanted to reread everything before that. But the rule was there is I'm trying what they called it, like your moon date or something. It was, and basically which was off of science, is if you spend 2 years on the moon, by then your body would have acclimated to the gravity of the moon so much so that if you went back to Earth, it'll be like, you know, you're being crushed under and your body just wouldn't be able to live that way. Of course, then he went ahead and he said this, and then what you do as a writer is when you set a rule, then you try your best to break it, which is what he did in the second book when he has a character go back to Earth and then try to meet with someone, but he's basically like barely staying alive and then does manage to get off the planet alive, but it's almost destroyed by it because the gravity is so strong. It takes its toll on your body, your lungs, your heart, just anything having to fight to survive. So I think that's probably where that was coming from. There is probably some science behind it.
And Heinlein dealt with those same things where the people from the moon did have to go back to Earth, and they were using technology to limit the effects. Like they were using a type of waterbed to limit the effects of the higher gravity that they weren't used to. But I loved in the book.
A lot of swimming, I think, probably too, right?
I think in the book he did a really good job with fleshing out the government there, how things ran. He left a real big opening with the infrastructure on the moon. You knew there were domes and there were connecting tunnels that were, you know, built into the base, the rock of the moon, but the actual layout, you didn't need to know. that you knew that there was a computer controlling things.
Right.
It was controlling the shipments of grain that they were growing on the moon that was going back to the Earth because the Earth had too many people and it couldn't feed them.
And they needed the food, right? Yeah. Which is
and as they were sending grain back, they were not only sending back grain, but they were sending back water.
Right.
And water was a limited resource on the moon. You couldn't recreate it. They had highly effective filters so that all of anything that went down the drain was somehow recycled.
Right. Yep.
So they were completely 100% water independent, except they were constantly sending some of it away back to Earth, and they weren't getting anything back from the Earth.
They're just giving up.
Receiving. And so that causes the revolution that happens in the book.
The conflict, literal and metaphorical. I'm just thinking here, as you're describing it here, too, again, you're doing a lot of, which the author was obviously intending, of, you know, colonizing a moon. It's, you know, it sounds like a very foreign and strange thing to try to wrap your mind around. But again, you're setting it in these familiar things of we need water, air, food, shelter to survive. These are all things we can totally relate to as human beings and have no problems stretching our mind then to, well, if we're going to set that up on the moon, that's what we need to have. And then the power struggle of governments. Again, we're exposed to that daily too in our lives. That's something, one that is obviously going to come into a big play, you know, when we eventually colonize other planets and things like that. But it's something that the reader can immediately connect to and then have an opinion and a stance on one way or the other. And I think it tied in a lot with the political thing of the time of just, you know, separating from the world government controlling, you know, capitalist government sort of thing and being more independent and free.
And I first read it when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. So I think that colored my view of the book. Because I was like, it's a story set in the future on the moon, but it could be any colony on any continent here on the Earth.
It could be an uninhabited island in the middle of nowhere that gets taken. Yeah.
It's basically the author saying we haven't really learned from past history with the way we've
colonized. And as we talk about this, I can't help thinking as we start to entertain the ideas of sending people to Mars, what's that going to start up, you know? All these different things. And the one factor that a lot of people don't talk about with Mars versus colonizing the moon, obviously it's the distance, but also it's beyond the heliosphere, which is this nice protective ring we have around us that protects us from radiation. And Mars doesn't have that at all. And it's going to make it much harder to even try to survive there. So I don't think that's going to work out.
Yeah, there's a lot of limiting factors about Mars.
Yeah. The idea is very cool, but
I'm behind going there, but as a colony, that we're going to need, domes or you know, all right, outside my lifetime, terraforming, you know.
There's a cool video game I've been playing called Surviving Mars. It's kind of like a civilization type thing where you're building stuff up, and it's very like therapeutic in that way because I love that sort of game. But and then they just introduced the new expansion, Green Mars, where you actually do terraform it by, like, melting the ice caps, building tons of factories to make CO2, and then also, like, grabbing asteroids and slamming them down to the Earth, down to the planet, which causes Mars quakes, but eventually you terraform. what else did you have? Oh, yeah, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, too, right?
Yes, I'll admit I have not read the books, but I did enjoy the BBC miniseries from the 80s. The recent movie was okay, but the 80s.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
BBC miniseries was much better.
And that was the trilogy that ended up, well, it's called the trilogy, but it's five books, right?
Correct, yeah. And that's just one. Douglas Adams is a. I don't think I've ever seen another writer exactly like him, mm-hmm. because he puts you in very mundane situations, even when it's fantastical. Like all of the aliens in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy are like from the very, they're either very bureaucratic or, you know, just very stereotypical. Like he took a stereotype from, you know, someone here on Earth and just expanded it to its absurdity. And that's what that alien race became. So yeah, I mean and of course, you know, you just never leave without a towel. I'm like, oh, it makes sense now.
It's towel day.
As an older person now, I'm like, yeah, I can see the benefit of having a towel.
I don't know. I haven't actually looked into the history of this with the writing of the books, but I've read them all. But I do feel one, they're a lot shorter than your usual big, heavy fantasy books. But I do feel this was very much a writing as he went along, kind of flowing with the story, throwing stuff in there, trying stuff out, and not necessarily world building. This is my crazy world with all these jokes and stuff I'm going to put in there, and then I'm going to set my character in there and have it go. I think it was much more of almost stream of consciousness. He was writing along, and he's just, because he's a funny writer, he was able to put jokes in as he was going along. And then, because I think in a lot of the books too, they start off on a different tangent. They pull some details back from the world going on, but in a lot of cases they just keep going on their own separate tangent, which I think leads into how he was just writing off the fly, almost like as he was going along, going with his characters and putting in as many jokes as he could. So that's a little different, I think, from your other way of doing it, where you have your world building set up beforehand before you start the story.
Now that makes a lot of sense.
I don't know this for a fact, but it's my belief
It very well could have been that way. Mm-hmm. Now that you say that, thinking about it, I'm like, if it was not done that way and he did it intentionally so the reader would experience it that way, but I'm just thinking about how after experiencing the miniseries, it's like, if you didn't watch it from the beginning, you were probably totally lost.
Right.
So, whereas I think maybe with the books, it would have been easier to pick up a book here or there and carry on. But with the miniseries, you were going to be totally lost.
Mm-hmm. And then you also mentioned Terry Pratchett, who is who's definitely influenced by Adams.
Yes. The Discworld series, mm-hmm. I actually have seen some of the movies, mm-hmm. or made for TV movies, right. That they made of, like Hogfather, mm-hmm. Was one. And, again, very, very, very humorous and very, the Discworld is something that it seems like he's put a lot of thought into, the different areas of the Discworld, so, yeah. The different characters in the Discworld. Mm-hmm. I don't think it would be as enjoyable if it wasn't as fleshed out as it is.
Right. Yeah. Again, I don't know. I've still not got around to reading them, but I've always been intimidated by when I've asked various people, well, what's the first book of the series? Where do you start? And no one can ever actually give me a concrete answer, because it's more like, well, this is this part of the world, this is this part. And sometimes they cross over. And so again, it might have been a similar thing where his first few books were just random tangents, but then as these tangents started filling in the world more, they started crossing over a bit, and that's when he had to flesh out the world more and then be able to build it into its big, huge, sprawling complexity. But again, he has, I can't really say again because I haven't read it, but I think again he has set rules that he does within the world so that when you're starting another book, it can feel totally different, a totally different and strange place, but because you know the rules from the previous books, you're still grounded in what's going to happen, well, where you're going to go and stuff like that, and what can happen.
Correct. I at a comic convention, I ran into someone who was a data analyst, and I was like, I had it on his table, and I'm like, hey, I do that for a living as well. And he was creating these infographics from different sci-fi and fantasy TV shows and novels and mm-hmm. things. He had one for Star Trek, and it was this infographic. It was a circle, and it showed every episode of the original series and how each character was connected from recurring characters were connected from one story to the next, how they progressed through those stories. He had every time a red shirt died, it was just very detailed, and things, you know, like things were connected. It was kind of strings here and there. And then he had something for Discworld, and he said, it's giving him the most problems of anything he's done. And it was just like a spaghetti it's thrown so on this thing, because things are so connected. And then he's like, these and five can be, yes, exactly. He's like, these five stories can be read all on their own. They don't, they're not connected to anything else. But then in this one, it's connected to those five, but it's also connected to the Tooth Fairy. And it's, he was just going on. It was really interesting to hear him talk.
But whenever, I talk with people who do, like kind of turn me off because of its weirdness and strange convolutedness. But they always speak of it with reverence and respect and admiration, too, that they, it's absolutely wonderful and incredible. So one day I'll probably get around to reading them. there is, I don't know if you read John Scalzi's book, Red Shirts.
No.
You might enjoy that. It's kind of a weird, almost breaking the fourth wall type of thing where a guy realizes all the, he's a red shirt, and then he realizes all the red shirts keep dying. And it's kind of a fun little play around with the whole idea of red shirts and stuff.